Cool. Thank you very much, everybody, for stopping by, both in presence and our, you know, in real life and online. My name is Nathan, Nathan Ruby. My background, a little bit about me. My background is systems and system administration. I've been doing it for 15, 20 years. So I started off as a system administrator and then kind of into web operations and DevOps and things of that nature. I've worked for universities, I've worked for energy companies, I've worked for a bunch of like startups, big, even small. Unfortunately, I keep leaving before there's like the giant cash payday, so that's my fault. So I've got a pretty wide set of experiences in terms of computational stuff. I did work at University of Georgia for a number of years and ran a bunch of central services there. So just to put everything in context, you know, I've done everything from like run, you know, FTP servers and email servers, WebCT servers to distributed computing and you know, Hadoop clusters and stuff like that. Cutting edge data processing. So that's about me. Specifically, I give you this introduction to let you know that because I'm a systems guy, you know, I'm systems first, networking second, kind of development third. Most of this talk will kind of center around Spark's ability to do SQL, and for my particular viewpoint, I would use it a lot for log parsing and like log stream analysis and stuff like that. So that's the demo that I'm going to have for you later today. And that's kind of the lens from which I work, or I'm going to kind of talk about Spark about. And I say this because I'm not an expert in Spark. Julian kind of conned me into doing this. No, he didn't talk me into this. At my current job, we are slowly, the data science and analysis guys are slowly starting to use Spark for doing some prediction stuff for our based on our data. I work for a company called Cover My Meds. We do prior authorization automation. So if you've ever needed a prescription and your insurance company wanted you to fill out a form and fax it to them, we'll fill out that form for you and fax it to them on your behalf online. We also have pioneered what's called electronic prior authorizations. So we to do that all over the internet, and in the case where an insurance company will automatically approve your prior authorization, you can get that done in 30 seconds instead of like 3 weeks. So, you know, that's pretty cool. Our data science and analysis guys, when we kind of look back at our 70 million PAs that we've processed for people and see if we can find any kind of signals in the noise and help sift through that data to help insurance companies, providers, pharmacies, stuff like that, understand some of the general trends so they can optimize and make that whole process a little smoother. So that's something that we're doing at work. That is handled by a separate group. I kind of help the data science guys do some Python things. And so that's how I was introduced to PySpark. And then just a few days later, hey, we needed something for the Python meetup. So I agreed, not fully understanding how large Spark's surface area was, to give this talk. So that's how we ended up here today. So that all said, what is Apache Spark? Apache Spark is, I don't have presenter's notes, so I'm just going to wing it here. Apache Spark is a fast and general engine for large-scale data processing. That is taken directly from spark.apache.org. So general and general in that statement is doing, it's doing a lot of work. it is a general data processing engine, but it is not a general compute engine. This is not a distributed grid scheduler or the ability to, you know, have, you know, 300 nodes report as a single system image. You're, like, it's not open source, you know, IRIX or, you know, open source, you know, super duper clustering stuff. It is horizontal parallelization of your code given, and a bunch of handy primitives for data, for handling your data. So by default, it kind of works on top of Hadoop, and it uses, it blends in with Hadoop very well. It will, if you install it into a Hadoop cluster, it will allow you to use any data source Hadoop can see. So that's HDFS or Hive or Spark or Shark or any of the MapReduce stuff. Basically anything that any data source that Hadoop can see, Spark can see it too. You don't need Hadoop in order to run Spark. It will run standalone. You can also deploy it through Mesos. What it uses Hadoop or Mesos for is cluster scheduling and shuffling of data bits, but that's about it. Blah, 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 blah. I feel like I had another note in my speaker note, but that's fine. So the data processing specifics, everything in what Spark is doing is basically once you load your data from whatever data source you can also load it in files or S3 or whatever. Once you load your data, it basically you turn it into a resilient distributed data set, the RDD, which is kind of the basic low-level primitive of Spark. RDDs are immutable. And they're kind of chopped up, so they end up on some n number of machines, they're immutable. Their ordering and where they land and how they land is left up to Spark. You don't really get that much control over where things execute or where things are chopped up as. That is why they're immutable. On top of RDDs, you have data sets and data frames. If you've ever used pandas, the Spark data frame is inspired by the pandas data frame, but it is not a pandas data frame. You can convert back and forth, but there is a cost to converting from a Spark data frame, which is basically serialized Java objects, into a pandas data frame, which is serialized Python objects. So converting back and forth is possible if you've got a lot of legacy code. That is not what I mean. If you've got a bunch of code in Python that you've already got and you're building something in Spark and you want to basically unify this, you can do that. But there is a processing cost from going from one to the other. So just be aware that that cost is there. That said, because of RDDs and because it handles a lot of the data for it, a lot of the underlying bits for you for getting your data into the right places, it's super fast. It is considerably faster than just plain old Hadoop MapReduce, which isn't that hard because Hadoop's MapReduce is not like awesome, especially when you're like talking about DFS, but or HDFS, so that's fine. It is fast. It allows you to do a lot more basic data analysis kind of stuff much quicker than it does than you would do just writing Python or Java or Scala. Hadoop-based jobs. So I'll show you some what a job and what a script looks like here in a second, and we can take a look at how fast it is on today's latest Macintosh hardware, which will be out of date in about 2 months. So that's generally what Spark is. It's data processing, but what exactly does that mean? So there's mlib. There's basically four main features or feature libraries within Spark. One is mlib, their machine learning library. It is not a complete, alternative to, creating artificial intelligence or whatever, blah, 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 blah. It is a reduced set, and I guess you would maybe call it an artisanal or curated set of machine learning libraries, algorithms, and supporting code in order to let you do simple stuff like recommendations or, kind of choosing some simple paths, stuff like that. Very cool, very useful. That's about all I know about it. SQL is kind of what I dug into mostly. So you can use Hive, ODBC, structured, and structured data can be queried with SQL or HiveQL syntax. A lot of the SQL libraries are just stuff on top of Hive, or at least the Hive query language. This having the ability to just kind of import your structured data and then do things with it kind of ad hoc or whatever, super cool, super awesome, and great for like reporting business intelligence or anything like that. So there is also a streaming library, so you can just kind of attach to any kind of eventing, any kind of data source that just sends you events and just listen to them and do whatever you want. There's a bunch of additional tools for like computing things within a sliding window, firing off asynchronous hooks based on events that come in come in through your pipeline, doing SQL queries to start relating inbound data to stuff in your SQL in your structured data data stores, or pushing everything together and doing batch submissions in the background. The example that everybody seems to like to give whenever they talk about Hive streaming is connect to Twitter, because there's a native Twitter connector. So if you just connect to the Twitter firehose, you can literally get a copy of every tweet being generated from Twitter and then do stuff with it, which is pretty cool. So if you wanted to say like make a Russian bot detector, you can do that in Spark pretty easily. And then GraphX, which is a graph computation abstraction library. So if you need to do kind of like Google's PageRank algorithm or something like that, GraphX is definitely where you would need to go. So that all said, there's lots of nifty stuff in there. And like I said, huge surface area to cover. I'm only going to kind of poke a little bit at the SQL stuff. And obviously the Python support. So one thing to note is that most of Spark is written in Java because it is kind of an offshoot of the Hadoop project. So a lot of it is not just written in Java, but it's written in Scala. So when you go to the documentation, a lot of times the documentation will have code samples that will say, show me this in Python, in Java, or in Scala. That's all great. We're going to focus on Python support today. The Python support is actually really, really good. It is, I think, better than some of the Hadoop, most of the Hadoop projects. Python is pretty much a first-class citizen in terms of feature support, library support, and stuff like that. And it is getting better on a release-by-release basis. So a lot of times you'll look at, you'll read some old, Stack Overflow or some old documentation or an old how-to from like Hortonworks, and they'll say, oh, you can't do this in Python, you have to do it in Scala, or you have to do it in Java. And then you go and look at the actual current API documentation. Surprise, you can do it in Python. So the Python support, bless you, is getting better. That said, because there are Python language bindings for most everything, there are still a few things that are only Java Scala. I want to say that the glaring omission right now is the streaming interface. And I think that is mainly because they haven't figured out a way to do that interface in a very performant manner. I suspect that there's a lot of like Java-based, like Scala introspection function stuff that doesn't really represent well in the Python API. That said, when you fire up Spark and you just say, hey, I have Spark, the basic REPL when you type in, Spark shell is a package called PySpark. And, you are sitting in somewhere between, a Python REPL and an Iron Python or a Jupyter notebook. It is not a Jupyter notebook, but it has a lot of the Spark stuff that you need already in the REPL loaded, and all the libraries are there. And it will also act as an interpreter if you just feed it a script. You don't really use that. You can use that very often. I have not, and I will not in our demo. There is also very strong Jupyter support. So Jupyter actually has a handy dandy notebook that you can just pull as a Docker image and then fire it up, and then poof, you get Jupyter and Python and Anaconda and Spark, and it all just works. And so that's what we're going to show you today. It takes you from 0 to 60 pretty darn quick. So because there is Python is not, it's not written directly in Python, there is obviously weirdness with types between RDDs, data frames, and data sets, and moving things between Java and Python. The library pretty much abstracts most of that stuff away, but you can get yourself into a situation where the untypedness or duck typing of Python and the strong typing of Java collide in weird ways. So just be very explicit with types and objects, and you should be good to go. Otherwise, you'll get like type errors, and it's pretty obvious what happened. So Spark is distributed. It's not a, you can install it on one machine, you can install it on 90 machines, you can install it on 1,000 machines. You do need multiple machines because even though it's fast, you do need multiple machines in a quantity reasonable for your data set. I've seen a couple of, in prepping this talk, I've seen a couple of people say, well, I've got, you know, this terabyte data set that I need to process, you know, every hour on the hour, and I've only got like an Amazon EC2, like M3 machine with like 4 gigs of RAM and one processor. That's not gonna work. It's fast, but it's not magic. It can't bend space-time, and it can't do all kinds of like just invent random computers out of thin air to make stuff happen. So you need machines in a quantity reasonable for your data set. What reasonable is depends on your data set and depends on what you're doing to that data set in Spark. But each machine does need storage, memory, and compute resources that are also reasonable for that data set. Because RDBs themselves are immutable, and the way that Spark works, Spark is going to load some part of your data on every individual. Spark is going to chop up your data and store bits and pieces of it on all of the nodes that it actually has access to when you start up your Spark context. Each one of those are going to do a bunch of computations on your data, whatever you tell it to do, and it's going to return some additional data set. So there's a bunch of scatter-gather operations that need to happen on all of that on your control node as well as all the worker nodes. So unlike in like Hadoop, where you can just have like generalized big worker pool and then generalized HDFS pool and then maybe like a main node here and a main node here, you need to be a little bit more thoughtful about your node type and make sure that it's you have storage, compute, and memory on each resources available for each machine, are on each machine. So RDBs are the resilient distributed data sets. They're the basic block that Spark uses. When you load data, you'll turn it into an RDB, you'll do a bunch of stuff, you'll do a bunch of transforms on that data, and those transforms will return a new data set. By default, the stuff in the middle between where you loaded and what you ended up with are not persisted in any way, shape, or form across the run of your machine, or across the run of your job. So once you kind of kill your Spark context, all that data goes away. You can persist data. You can cache it to memory, you can cache it to disk, you can cache it to a couple other different places if you need to, depending on what your job is, how much data you have. You're like going through tons and tons of genomes and you have, you know, n number of steps between, you know, ingesting data and getting an answer. And you've got to go back, you want to go back and do, you know, 30 regressions on every, at every step. You probably want to cache some of those intermediate data sets so you can speed up and not have to read them. Because RDBs are immutable, every RDB is immutable, and Spark figures out which bits it needs to keep around in order to get from start to finish at any point in time. So even if it loses some of the null bits, it'll just repeat them, which is cool. And that's, you know, one of the things that you need to do in a distributed system, but it can also cause some problems in terms of latency and computational and memory resources. I mentioned this before, it's made for returning data, not doing general purpose computing. So, you know, make sure that your job set really is doing things with data, and not like other things like running website or CRM. As a nice hint, or as a nice feature, AWS actually has a product called Elastic MapReduce, which basically gives you, you know, kind of vendor Hadoop. It has a Spark offering as well, so you can literally go to AWS's Elastic MapReduce, say, make me a cluster, here's how big I want it, make it a Spark cluster, not a Hadoop cluster, and poof, you get Spark. It's actually super duper cool. You can then ingest a bunch of data, run your jobs, tear it down, and pay. I left one running for about 2 weeks on AWS M4s, and I think it was like $78. So, it's handy. So why would you use this? Business intelligence reporting? Our business intelligence reporting? If you are kind of in the zone where like Tableau is not doing it for you, or some of the other, or the Oracle business reporting things called now. Once you kind of outgrow that, you need like super duper custom custom metrics, or you need like something that's more real time, or very, very touches a lot of different data sources, or touches data sources that like Oracle stuff is not going to talk to. This is a great way to build all that backend intelligence in order to do that. Other people like Uber are using it for like real-time ETL. So when data enters one database, it, you know, gets an event notification through the streaming interface and sucks it out, does a bunch of permutations, puts it in the report. Forecasting and prediction is now something that you can inline into your ETL process, which is actually pretty cool if you want to do that sort of thing. Again, if you're like Uber or Twitter, that sounds like a great idea. If you're not, maybe it isn't. Data enrichment is also a great way. It's a great thing, and that's kind of what I'm going to show you a little bit today, is to be able to take some data, either structured or unstructured, restructure it, give it some context, start doing, add some synergies and linkages between that data and other data you have, and then even just taking unstructured data and structuring it and spinning out the structured version is, incredibly useful, and being able to do that faster is awesome. Along with all of that, you can do some forms of event detection with the, if you wanted to couple, say, the streaming interface and machine learning interface, and where you just kind of watch data go by and say, this is anomalous. This is anomalous. This is. That is actually something that I'd like to, that is a pet project that I'm kind of thinking about doing in my spare time. Not that I have spare time, but I think it'd be very, very cool sit down and say, watch your metrics and blog streams and be able to learn from it, and then be able to start predicting when bad things are about to happen. Maybe that's a dumb idea, but I have time, I can do whatever I want. So let me give you a little bit of a demo about doing some data enrichment and what the SQL kind of interface looks like. This is all in GitHub. It's on my GitHub at nathanruby/spark-demo. If you want to take a look, follow along, or just take a clone it and have that information for later. Before I get started with that, are there any questions or anything like that? Have I gone too fast? Did that make sense?
Request from the remote folks. Could you maybe speak a little bit louder?
Like I said, my fan is just spinning like crazy. Thanks, Zoom. Whoa. All right. Oh, sharing is paused. Stop sharing. And let's reshare. Zoom recording. Sorry. Good question. Did not realize it had stopped recording. I don't know where it did that. Probably when I unshare, when I change the screen sharing. Okay. Well, now we're recording. Yay. The next thing that we're going to do is create, from our Spark context, we're going to create a session. We need to have a session open in order to do like temporary tables and some of the SQL stuff that we're going to show. So run that. And if you notice, it's running, it takes a minute. And what it's doing in the background here, if we take a look at the logs, that's basically just bringing in, importing all of the Spark libraries and starting up a Spark context. It's not actually processing anything yet, it's just kind of getting ready to get ready. And now it's done. So I don't know how many people here, as we move on to step two, how many folks here parse Apache logs, log files on a regular basis, or do a lot of regular expression stuff? Yeah, most people probably do fling some regular expressions. I never know what that is, what
how familiar people are with regular expressions. So step two here is kind of verbose. In Apache log, Apache log lines are, Apache log files are a series of logs, log lines. Each line is an event. Each event has a bunch of data associated with it. There are a couple of standard formats. This is the one that we're looking at is Apache common log format. And what we need to do is basically take this line of unstructured data that we have here with all of our various things, and we need to kind of break it into a we need to give it some structure and say, you know, what's the IP address? What is the remote ident for the file, for the remote server? What is the HTTP auth user? What's the date and time of the event? What's the request look like in terms of the request itself? Has a has an HTTP verb, a path, and then a protocol that it used? What kind of response code was sent? What kind of how many bytes were sent in the response? What was the refer? What was the user agent? And from this particular log file, we just have this extra field that like nobody knows what it is. So it's just whatever. So how do we parse that into, how do we parse this line? Oh. How do we parse this wonderful line into, you know, actual structured data? So we're gonna use a regular expression. And then I have basically an example of what the regular expression looks like. It's nasty, blah, 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 blah. And we don't know what that last field is. It's often vhost in a lot of files, but this, in our data set, I looked, and it's just minus sign. So we're just gonna assume that something's site specific and we're gonna just scrub it and not worry about that last field. We'll parse it, but we'll just not worry about it because it's none of our concern. So we're gonna apply this this regular expression to our data file, and we will need to feed each log line event, a log line, into a function that returns a data set. So, or a row of data set. So I wanna take a quick sidebar and make a public service announcement for structured logging. Hi, I have been parsing these kinds of logs for 20 years. It's terrible and no one likes it, no one. The guy who says he likes it, he's a liar, he's lying to you, does not like it. Or the Stockholm effect has kicked in, and you know he's just a victim of his own mind now. So as you're doing stuff like this, and this doesn't just apply to like Apache log lines, it applies to any kind of log file that you're doing, or any kind of like a series of events where you want to be able to go back to this data later, or parse it in any way, shape, or form, rather that isn't you just reading it. Please consider using a structured logging format for getting logs out of your web server or whatever. CSV separated key value pairs are great. JSON is a wonderful alternative. It adds a little bit of extra noise, but it still compresses pretty well for long-term storage. And once you parse it, you can keep like actual data structures in it. These prevent you from having to do everything that I just explained and everything that I'm just gonna show you. Reduces the time to value for your data, makes it parsable in a lot more places than this. If you've ever done logging I've implemented a bunch of logging systems in a bunch of different places, and this is kind of the first week or two is figuring out what the logging format looks like, which values are you actually using, use I, capital I, not little I in this format string, blah, 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 blah. Get all the data right, get it shipping correctly, then get it right, a regular expression that parses it, then have it break because there's something that doesn't work the way you thought it did, blah, 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 blah. If you have data, structured data, you know what you're getting. It's just so much easier to parse, and your life is going to be so much easier. Without further ado, so this is the function that we're going to have that parses our logs. Here's our regular expression from our explanation above. We're going to import regular expression, put that into a variable, and just define a function that does a per line parse. Takes in a log line, does a match via research. You'll notice there's about a bunch of back references here, so that in match will return a bunch of additional group entries. So we can just say group 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in order to add some additional, in order to start giving structure to our data. What we will return is a dataset row that has all of the information that we need structured with actual key value kind of pairs. So if I run the cell, nothing happened because all I did was define a function. I didn't actually use it, I just defined it. So now we need to load our log file. Spark specifically does lazy loading, and it tries to do everything as lazily as possible. So I'm gonna run this. It's gonna do some stuff, but it's gonna go pretty quickly. And you'll notice it didn't log in the background here. It's just, you know, there's IPython or Jupyter saving stuff in the background. When we tell it, hey, here are my log files, and then here, Spark, go look at these log files, all it does is say, hey, are there log files there? Yes, cool. Doesn't open the log files, doesn't try to read them, just like confirms that they are actual files. Once they're actual files, we know about it, we can run the next line, which will also run very quickly. Oh, there it is. What this does is basically say, now that I have raw log files, I want to map them into, with this, I want to run a mapping, I want to map them in order to create structure, so I will parse them with my Python function, so therefore I will parse them and return a data set into the parse log files variable. Then I can take that data set, turn it from a RDD to a data frame, and from a data frame I can register an SQL table called log data. At that point I can just query log data like it was an SQL database. There's a lot of stuff going on in those two little lines that didn't actually do anything yet. It's pretty awesome to be able to just say, now that you have a file, just ingest it, restructure it, and then turn it into turn it into an SQL data set in two lines of code is like, I worked at a company that literally built a business that took it 9.5 months to basically implement those two lines of code. We've come a long way in like 8 years, but that's still pretty powerful. So now we've got our data, we've told Spark enough stuff to know where our log is, how to parse it, what to do with it once we've parsed it, and to create this SQL table and how to create it. So now we actually want to use it. So what we're going to do is issue an SQL command from log data against that temporary table that we've already defined. This is going to be what actually triggers Spark to go through, read the data in, chop it up, start processing it on a number of different processors, and then return basically a reduced set via your SQL query. So all I've done here is ask for a count, account and the IP address of log data grouped by IP address, order by count descending. So basically, who are the top hitters from this log file? What IP addresses are? What's the count of IP addresses and order them by count, so I can see who the top hitter of this web server is. So if I run this, it's running. And if we go back and take a look at our notebook, we'll start all of a sudden seeing Spark doing some stuff. Normally this goes faster, but normally I'm not like broadcasting a web conference, so please bear with me. When I said, hey, go look at, when I said use local star at the beginning on establishing the Spark context, that basically allowed me to say, use everything that you can possibly find in your local system. In those cases, I've got two processors dedicated to my Docker virtual machine here in the background. So it's kind of splitting everything up into at least two chunks and then running those in parallel in reassembly. If you had some monster 64 processor machine, you could do that as well. So it's done all that in the background, and now I've got a nice, boring, but, pretty cool top 20 rows of IP addresses by count. So 198, 51, 56, 189 here hit me 16,000 times in the time period of this this log file. The log file's got like 3 years worth of data, so that's probably the owner of this particular web server. But you know, if I were doing, let's say I'm doing web operations and all of a sudden my site goes down and I don't know why, I've got 150 web servers and I need to know who's, you know, I've got a load balancer sending traffic across every single one of those 150 web servers. You know, how do I know which one of them, you know, what IP address is hitting all those web servers? Because every individual web server is going to have a slightly different set of logs. Piping them all into Spark and just doing something like this really gives me a great way of being able to. Yeah. It gives me a great way to be able to like cook all this data from multiple places down into one useful set. So if I worst part about having people watch me type is that it makes me nervous and I don't like do it. So I'm really a better typer like than this, a little bit better, but so all I did was basically just give it another thing that says select count, and if I had done it in different so I wouldn't have had to repeat the first one. Now we may. Anyway, while we wait to see how many things are in our data, or how many rows are in our data, what if we wanted to order this by date? Because it's SQL, because it's Spark, two interesting things. So in normal and SQL, like there's close to a million records. So 914,000 records. Each record's probably, I don't know, like 1,200 bytes. So, you know, and the source file itself is like 5 megabytes compressed. And it's like 75 megs compressed. So it's not a lot of data, but I mean, I'm also running it in a Docker container in a VM on a MacBook Pro while broadcasting. So big is relative given the size of the container. So one thing that we'd often want to do is order by date. So in SQL land, we can just, you know, say, order by a date time. And assuming that you had a row or some column or some amount of data in your data set that was representative of date, and Spark understood that, we could just say order by date and it would do it. Our data set has a date stamp, but we didn't actually parse it as a date as a date type or a time type or a date time type. So the data set that we have doesn't really understand when anything is. It just has this random random string that contains some data that is a timestamp, but we haven't parsed as a timestamp. So we're going to do that in SQL land, or in the SQL query itself, with this function, the toTimestamp function. And then the toTimestamp function will take what column you're trying to turn into a timestamp, and then this lovely, wonderful string here, which kind of describes what that field looks like in order to be able to parse it into something useful for date time. That is the Java simple date format time, which is why if you're very familiar with Python, that looks like terrible because it's Java simple date format. Java simple date format, it's not great, it doesn't look good, but this is one of these times when hey, even though I'm working in Python, the underlying libraries are all Java, so I've got to do some stuff in Java. Those examples. So all we're going to do here is basically the same query, but now we're going to order it by date, and we're going to limit it by 10. But I guess we're not going to have it. So this will show you what the actual string date time is, and what we end up parsing it into a timestamp as. So we can, and it'll also sort it by most recent. So the last entries in the log file, assuming that your log file is written in order, which isn't necessarily always the case. Again, this is doing the same kind of stuff here. One thing to note is that what this thing is called, the to timestamp, is user-defined function. You can actually inject those yourself into Spark's SQL context as Python functions, but there's a significant cost to doing that. So you normally, when you want to write a UDF, you do need to write it in Scala or Java, and then inject that, and then call that function from the Python side. Otherwise, every single individual row is going to go through a serialization, deserialization, go to Python, have something like that. So that's kind of expensive. So blah, blah, blah. Obviously, we've got IP address, and then a date, and then a date time, and then an actual date. So this string here is just a string that is our timestamp, and then the date next to it is an actual, we parsed that string into an actual date. And then ordered this file and to see the last 10 entries. So that is an example of calling a UDF and some of the Java Python funkiness. And then last but not least, what happens if, oh, lovely typo. What if we wanted to run our data through an external program? This was something that came from somebody else who wanted to add a huge data set and basically for every record wanted to run it through some other program, record the result of that program, or record the output of that program and then mesh the two together. So you can sort of do that. I didn't do the meshing the two together because that's not specifically Sparky. But you can basically use something called pipe, which will basically take every row in your data set and pipe it through an external program and record the output. It's efficient because the pipe assumes that it can spawn that program, and then that program will simply sit there and wait for input coming in and spit things out, spit out the appropriate response coming out, and that it's FIFO, right? So first in, first out, and then we can relate all that stuff. So if we, in our fancy pants example, we want to, we don't know how to reverse a line in Python, oh no. So we're gonna use user bin reverse to do that. So what we do is we take our original log files, we'll pipe them through user bin reverse and collect them into our variable. And then just to show you that we actually reversed it and that it's actually reversed, the first line here in our output is the first line of our log reversed. And then the second line here is just the original log file data that we imported at the beginning. And then I just reversed that line, that string in Python. The only difference here, you'll notice, is because I reversed, in the second example, I stringified an array or an entry, and then reversed it, the corresponding brackets also got reversed. But other than that, you can see that it's the same log file, it's the same log line, and they're otherwise identical. So you could do that in order to do, you would use this and say if you had some like really crazy C-based program that was just a black box, right? Some researcher says, run this program and put this data into my program, and then my program will give you the answer to life and the universe and everything. And you don't have any visibility into that thing. You can still run it through Spark with your data set and then be able to manipulate its results. So that's the end of my little demo. I hope that was kind of useful, at least in some ways, in terms of showing you kind of what you can do with the SQL side of Spark and how you can do some log parsing. Where I gave you some good ideas and it was useful. Any other questions or comments or concerns or just chit chat? I know we're 3 minutes over, so I want to be respectful of your time.
The real difference between map and pipe is where you're defining a function and you map it to the data, but pipe is giving you some external black box.
Right. So pipe basically opens up a program and then just leaves it open and spits data into it as fast as possible, expecting the program to do all the other stuff. Map is very similar to Python or map in any other language, where it just apply a function, a transformation function to every value in the set. The specific use case there is somebody who's doing was a chip designer and wanted to run simulations. Basically, he put data, run it through an algorithm that his chip, in Verilog or VHDL or something like that, and wanted to make sure that the output was correct, and otherwise his chip was not poor. So he had a couple hundred thousand data sets that he needed to make sure it came out the right way through this algorithm. So he was like, could I use this to make that process easier? Because right now, he has to do it by hand, and it takes him a day. He's like, well, if I could just put that in the cloud, batch it. I don't have to worry about it again. Awesome. Yeah. So that is why that's there. That's actually just there for that. but I thought it would be useful, generally useful for everybody else. So I thought that's good. Anybody else? Anything? I hope this was useful for you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right. Thank you very much. And thanks everybody who is playing along at home. I apologize. I cannot use your conferencing system very effectively. And I put a big hole in the middle of the recording. So